Welcome to On the Money, where you can find out anything and everything to do with finance, business, and the economy. On the Money, cast live from the studios of Radio 2SER nationwide on the Community Radio Network. I'm Daniel Ellison, and coming up on the program...
In a lot of countries, if people want to pay their electricity bill, they've got to take a full day off work, get on a bus for 3 hours, travel to the nearest town, line up at a counter, pay the bill, and then get back on the bus. You know, often they have to do that just to access, they do have a bank account, just to access the bank account. Very expensive to be poor in lots of ways. You know, in India, in a lot of provinces, a lot of states, they were losing 40% of welfare payments to corruption.
It really makes it hard.
Almost a third of the world's adult population actually don't have something as basic as a bank account. Things we take for granted in first world countries, like paying a bill easily over the internet and moving money about, just aren't available in less developed and remote areas. Research done on sustainable finance aims to redress the balance and help poorer people in poorer countries get access to basic financial technology. Also coming up on the program...
It really makes it hard for somebody to make a decision with any surety moving forward when we're seeing housing prices come off in the Sydney and Melbourne markets for the first time in a long time. And I think some of that disruption in that political arena is really starting to impact people's confidence in making decisions in long-term type investments and property purchases.
A new report shows that consumer confidence is down. This means people tend to hold onto their money, and this has a double whammy when it comes to the economy. So, should we be worried? We'll find out coming up on the Money. But first, you may remember that Westpac made headlines last year when ASIC issued them a $35 million fine for irresponsibly approving loans that it shouldn't have. Well, earlier this week, the federal court announced they were rejecting the fine. Why did the fine get rejected? And what does this mean going forward? Ben Robinson investigates.
In March of last year, it was reported that Westpac were being taken to the federal court by the Australian Securities and Investment Commission. ASIC claimed that Westpac had failed to properly assess whether borrowers could actually meet their repayment obligations before signing a home loan contract. ASIC claimed that Westpac had issued more than 10,000 loans that should not have been approved automatically, and the bank was served a $35 million fine for their wrongdoings. Sounds like a fair move, right? Well, this week, the federal court rejected the fine, meaning Westpac doesn't have to cough up any cash at the moment. Now, this move is totally unprecedented. Everyone assumed that the fine would be approved with very little hassle, but Justice Nye Perham has accused both Westpac and ASIC's lawyers of glossing over the details, claiming that both parties have actually failed to agree on what the law allows. So now we have two stories. There's the fact that Westpac have been dealing out dodgy loans, and now there's an argument about the law as well. According to Cameron Murray, senior economist at the Australia Institute, we shouldn't look at them as two different stories.
Look, I think you can't separate both of them because the legal question is, were the loans dodgy? What does the law actually say? And from what I can understand, if they can't agree that the lending contravened the law, then what's the fine for? Is it just to make the issue go away and carry on as usual with no clear understanding of what we want as a society in terms of responsible bank lending?
When ASIC announced the fine, they said they were also investigating up to 10 other banks as well. That was back in March 2017. Cut to November 2018, we've only seen them call out Westpac. So what happened there?
I have no idea. I mean, there are limited resources to do this. And, you know, if the law is unclear, then it seems a little bit troubling to try and do this 11 times before you've done it once in a convincing way. But no doubt this is the beginning of a process where other banks will have their lending looked at more closely, and whatever precedent comes out of this will be then much more easily applied.
That was Cameron Murray again. He believes that ASIC is simply testing the waters with this fine, and once the legal definitions get sorted out, we can expect much more to follow. But for now, let's focus on what Westpac did wrong. For starters, it begins with the way they calculate their customers' living expenses. When you apply for a home loan, the bank has to take a bunch of things into consideration, like your job, your location, whether or not you have kids. So before they grant the loan, they calculate your cost of living. Westpac have admitted to using a system called the Household Expenditure Measure, or HEM for short. AGM does these calculations automatically to save the bank staff having to actually crunch the numbers themselves. But this is what has landed them in hot water, because the AGM isn't always accurate.
So the household expenditure measure is an index for household expenses. The household expenditure measure was developed by the Melbourne Institute. Basically, the household expenditure measure is a weighted average that takes into account absolute necessary expenses of households.
That was Harry Shull, Professor of Finance at the University of Technology, Sydney. So what the household expenditure measure does is rely on averages to compare customers. However, this isn't always accurate because some households spend way more than others and some spend way less. That's where things get a bit tricky. Here is Professor Shull again to talk about why it can be misleading.
The index is not poor by definition. The problem with the index is by design. It's an average. Often taking average assumptions may or may not be accurate. And then, you know, the loan amounts are large enough to support a more rigorous and more detailed analysis.
ASIC have stated that when assessing a customer's living costs before approving a loan, they have compared aspects of their life such as location, the marital status and their age. But one thing they haven't compared was their income. This is referred to as a low-doc loan, where the customer isn't required to provide much proof of their living situation. Cameron Murray, the economist we heard earlier, has some personal experience with this.
I've had the personal experience in the past of getting a low-doc loan and just declaring what my income was and declaring what my expenses are. I mean, it's been going on for nearly 20 years, this generous lending. It works for the banks in a rising market. The scrutiny over the buyer's income is not so important for them if the asset that the loan's secured against keeps going up in value.
So let's now turn to the legal aspect of it. ASIC have felt that Westpac were complacent when it came to approving loans, and they decided to launch a case against the bank. But the two parties couldn't agree on what the law actually meant. The law in question is the National Consumer Credit Protection Act. And here is Professor Jill North from Deakin University to talk about what the law does.
So this is the main act in Australia that covers credit or lending in Australia. And it was brought in as a separate stream of law to financial services law, which is regulated under the Corporations Act. And it's intended to govern all forms of lending.
Specifically, Justice Nyperam drew attention to Section 128 of the Act, which is there to make sure banks only lend money to people who are able to pay it back on time. And this is at the core of the misunderstanding between Westpac and ASIC. ASIC felt that Westpac had behaved improperly because they used the somewhat inaccurate household expenditure method benchmark. But there isn't enough information for Justice Perham to approve of the fine. Professor Jill North explains.
Justice Perham is saying, well, he can't apply a penalty in this case because he doesn't know out of all the loans that are at issue, and there's more than 250,000 of them in this case, how many of them potentially breached the actual responsible lending rules. So at one extreme, one might argue that the provisions mean that you can never apply a benchmark.
So what does the future look like? Now that the case has been rejected by the federal court, does this offer a glimmer of hope for Westpac and maybe other banks in the industry? After all, there is the possibility that ASIC will drop the case altogether or be forced to lower the fine. However, Cameron Murray is optimistic.
In my ideal world, they do get to the bottom of the legal question and say, yes, this is your obligation as a lender to make a judgment in what's in the best interest of the borrower. There's always a chance that the whole thing is dropped altogether. ASIC doesn't think it wants to argue the case and doesn't know if it can win the legal arguments. It could go either way from here. I'm just hoping that there's enough political pressure and interest amongst the regulators to actually come to a conclusion and issue fines instead of precedent.
Cameron Murray, senior economist at the Australia Institute, ending that report by Ben Robinson.
My name is François Carrière. I am at the UTS Business School, and you are listening to On the Money, summing up finance in one easy bite. We'll be right back.
You're listening to On The Money, finding out everything to do with money, finance and business. And we're broadcasting around Australia on the Community Radio Network from the studios of Radio 2SER in Sydney. I'm Daniel Ellison. According to the World Bank's 2017 Global Findex, between 2010 and 2017, around 1.2 billion people, mostly from the developing world, opened an account with a formal or mobile financial service provider for the first time through tools such as money mobile apps, digitizing financial and identification, among others. A new report, FinTech for Financial Inclusion, presented this week at the third annual Sustainable Finance Research Conference in Luxembourg, is providing governments a roadmap to harness this acceleration of fintech or financial technology in the last decade.
Phones, in a very short answer, you have to understand a lot of what we take for granted in the West was not able to be done in poorer countries. So, for instance, in a lot of countries, if people want to pay their electricity bill, they've got to take a full day off work, get on a bus for 3 hours, travel to the nearest town, line up at a counter, pay the bill, and then get back on the bus. You know, often they have to do that just to access, if they do have a bank account, just to access the bank account. Very expensive to be poor in lots of ways. You know, in India, in a lot of provinces, a lot of states, they were losing 40% of welfare payments to corruption because the recipients of the payments were illiterate. It was a paper-based system. It was sort of a breeding ground for corruption. If you're a government, pushing your payments out electronically to people's mobile phones so they receive an electronic credit on their phone creates a paper trail that's able to be audited. It makes the opportunity for corruption much, much smaller. And it gives people money that they can do things with electronically, you know, pay the electricity bill without taking a day off work. Stuff we take for granted, but didn't exist in a lot of countries.
The report largely focuses on developing a framework to harness this new vibrancy that's emerging with the rise of fintech in the developing world, for example. So there are four pillars to this framework. Could you take us through the four pillars and explain how they work as a whole to harness the growth of financial technology?
The most important pillar is the first one. The first one is digital identity. Again, this is something that we don't have yet in Australia. The government is now starting to work on it. It's called GovPass is the initiative. But it's even much more important in developing countries. So the idea is, in a lot of these countries, people don't have documents. They don't have passports. They don't have driver's licenses. They can't prove their identity easily. If you can't prove identity, you really can't get access to financial services because, you know, banks have heavy obligations to make sure they know exactly who they're dealing with so as to limit money laundering or terrorism financing activities. So first pillar is digital identity, giving people a digital way of proving who they are. And India has led the world in that. Aadhaar is their initiative, and they've got, you know, 10 fingerprints, 2 iris scans, photographs and other identifiers like, you know, name, address, date of birth, everything, on 1.1 billion people. So that's been an extraordinary initiative of the Indian government. Once you have that sort of identity, people can open bank accounts without having to physically travel these long distances. They can open bank accounts electronically. They can initiate payments electronically. That's the digital identity piece that's really the transformative piece. Now, Aadhaar's had some problems in how it was implemented. I think, to be fair, the government rushed it out too quickly and, you know, didn't protect people's privacy well enough and that sort of thing. But that doesn't mean it was the wrong choice. The other three pillars, the second pillar is digital payments, providing a way for payments infrastructure and electronic payment systems. You know, again, if you've got a digital identity as the foundation, you can build your payments infrastructure on top of that, make it key off that. The third pillar is getting government to use these things. In a lot of countries, the goal needs to be to move people away from cash to these much more efficient ways of transacting, and people have understandable resistance to it. So the government needs to sort of engineer a cultural shift. And the best way to do that is for government to start to send its welfare payments out electronically. That'll force people into using digital money, and then they'll find out how much more convenient it is. And then the fourth pillar is something that's very futuristic for most developing markets, which is being financial infrastructure, the sophisticated stuff digitally. That's in Australia, the Australian Stock Exchange is doing that at the moment. It's using blockchain.
to completely, you know, reform and recast its clearing and settlement operations. So share trading on the stock exchange is going to become a lot quicker in Australia in the next couple of years. And, you know, that's pillar four. But as I say, that's a long way away for most countries.
Using these four pillars, and if they're successfully implemented and adopted, how do you believe this could change basically the way we do finance in the world and the world economy?
Look, it's got a huge amount of potential. For instance, in our backyard, one of the problems is remittances. We have a lot of people from the Pacific Islands working in Australia and New Zealand, and we've got the most expensive remittance channels in the world. For some of these people, to send $500 that they've earned picking fruit in the Riverina back to Tonga or Samoa or the Solomons can cost them, you know, $80. You know, that should cost a dollar or two. If it's all done digitally, it should cost a dollar or two. The problem is our banks aren't interested in supporting the money transfer operators who can do it reasonably cheaply. They're actually actively putting the money transfer operators out of business. There's a complicated story as to why they're doing that, but the answer to it is technology. You know, if people could prove who they are digitally in a secure way, there'd be no reason for those transfers to be so heavily taxed.
Going back to something you mentioned earlier, for example, the Aadhaar system in India, the identification system.
Yeah.
So just quoting the report here, so any fintech, regtech-based approach to financial inclusion must recognise that technology is not perfect and can have unanticipated consequences. What are some of the risks in implementing this framework, and how could they be mitigated?
Well, I think one of the mistakes India made, for instance, was it allowed actual biometrics to be recorded by some devices. So rather than what being recorded was simply a ticker across, this is confirmed, this person is who they say it was, they let, in some cases, merchants have copies of fingerprints on the device that took the fingerprint. You know, that's a sort of fundamental mistake. You've got to protect people's biometrics a lot more carefully than that. I mean, they fixed that, but that was a sort of interim learning error, if you like. The other obvious one is, you know, data privacy. Who owns the data? You know, who can get access to it? How secure is it? You know, that sort of thing. That's one of the big ongoing challenges, and we haven't fully worked out the answer to that. I mean, we have this ridiculous model that you consent, if you use Facebook or Google or anything, you consent to them using the data in accordance with their privacy policy, but that's a broken model everywhere because nobody reads the policies, right? And even if you read them, you don't have any commercial leverage to renegotiate them with the provider. It's on a take-it-or-leave-it basis. So the law has a lot of work to do to catch up and, you know, empowering consumers to actually have some voice as to what's done with their information.
KPMG Law and King and Wood Mallesons Professor of Disruptive Innovation and Law at the University of New South Wales Scientia, Professor Ross Buckley, ending that story by Jack Birkfeld.
pounds or cents. No way to ever burn nobody. It's just all expense. No way to earn except there is no innocence. No, baby, that's no way to hurt. That ain't no way to serve.
That's a bit of the song Easy Money by Johnny Marr, and you're listening to On The Money around Australia on the Community Radio Network. I'm Daniel Ellison. You feeling encouraged to save after hearing about the latest rate hike? A new study has found that the world of politics and the economy have poor consumer confidence, and it reflects on how we use our money. It can influence us to save rather than spend or hold off on buying a new house for now. Kevin Suarez spoke with Rod Attrill, General Manager of Banking at Compare the Market, and asked him what kinds of events this year have led to the current climate of poor consumer confidence.
Certainly on the economy side, I think the consumers are seeing where the RBA is holding the cash rate. I mean, it's 27 months in a row that the cash rate's been held. So it's been the same as it has been since mid-2016. So that always gets a lot of info and a lot of press in regards to those decisions. But consumers are then starting to see things like interest rate rises going up on their individual home loan. So where there's a decision made at a much higher level, it's not sort of filtering down to a consumer that may be paying a housing loan off, where they're seeing out of cycle interest rate rises from the various banks and building societies.
How are people treating their own personal finances because of the events of this year, such as the leadership spill?
It goes to the confidence factor. They're seeing that disruption in the political arena, and it really makes it hard for somebody to make a decision with any surety moving forward. When we're seeing housing prices come off in the Sydney and Melbourne markets for the first time in a long time. And I think some of that disruption in that political arena is really starting to impact people's confidence in making decisions in long-term type investments and property purchases.
Is there an event where the effect has a direct correlation to the cause?
I think certainly coming back to the interest rate rises and those type of that poor consumer confidence, people are trying to put more money aside and make more frugal decisions in regards to their personal finances because they really are unsure of where they're going to go and what's going to happen moving forward. So certainly some decisions that have impacted are certainly the interest rate rises. I think the leadership spills and the uncertainty in the American market, American political scene, where we've just come out of the midterms and there hasn't been really a good point to any stability there. Again, people are concerned about what's going to happen with the economy moving forward, so are probably not spending as much, which is then impacting various factors for consumer sentiment and those type of things.
Do events happening overseas affect the finance here in Australia?
Yes, certainly. I think the American landscape certainly does to a large extent. They see the unrest that is in that country. Brexit to some extent, although as we've seen in the last few days, Brexit is starting to drag out, although a decision is probably imminent and there was some movement on that overnight. I think people see those type of things and then see some of the local political changes and then get concerned in regards to how stable the economies are in probably our biggest partners in England and America. The confidence in Donald Trump obviously is quite polarising. So people get concerned in regards to those type of things, and it then impacts what they need to do and how they make decisions locally.
What can be done to improve consumer confidence in politics?
Yeah, it's a really tricky one, Matt. I think stability is the only thing that's going to help consumers in our country make a decision with some confidence moving forward. Until we see that, and we're about to go into an election year, so that may not happen for another 6 months. So it's going to be tough going for people to have any confidence at all in the political arena. And it really does depend on what happens in the election next year. If the incumbent government gets returned, maybe that'll give us a little bit more stability moving forward for a little while. But also with the number of leadership spills and that type of unrest we see, it is very difficult for people to even feel confident about where they're travelling with their own personal finances. The big thing for me is that people should always, whenever anything happens or whenever they get anything like an out-of-cycle interest rate rise or any type of bill, it's important that they compare and have a look at the market, and it's important that they take a little bit of time to see if they're getting the best possible deal, and that's what we're here to do.
When it comes to instability in finances, in personal finances, how would this affect the macroeconomic area?
There's decisions being made on a macro level in regards to overseas investments, certainly in Sydney and in Melbourne, where our biggest markets lay. So those type of decisions are being made, which might be made in regards to a general percentage of overseas investment being allowed, but it also affects the local markets where people may be trying to buy and sell a house, and there may not be as many people in that market now that are looking to purchase at any one time.
Rod Attrill, General Manager of Banking at Compare the Market, ending that report by Kevin Suarez. That's all we have time for on the Money this week. We'll hope you'll tune in again next week to find out everything you need to know about money, finance and business. Hello if you're listening at 2WET, 2 Wet Tank FM in Kempsey, or 2 Bob Radio in Taree, or 8CCC in Alice Springs. Thanks to all our producers this week, Ben Robinson, Kevin Suarez and Jack Birkfeld. And of course, thanks again to our executive producer, Roderick Chambers. On the Money is produced in the studios of Radio 2SER for the Community Radio Network. You can find all of our shows and stories at 2ser.com/onthemoney. You can also follow us on Twitter. You can look for On the Money 2SER, and you can also find us on Facebook. I'm Daniel Ellison. We'll be back again next week to give you the inside running on all things financial. Thanks very much for your company.
Would $10,000 help you get your local project up and running? The City of Sydney's matching and environmental grants are now open. Grants support projects that involve genuine community participation and assist residents, workers and visitors in the City of Sydney area. Grants close 5 p.m. Monday, November 19. Visit cityofsydney.nsw.gov.au/grants. City of Sydney sponsors 2SER 107.3.
Ever since I was a child, I tried to be the best. So what happened? My family and friends all said I was blessed. So what happened? It was supposed to be all so exciting to be teaching of Christ across the sea. But I allowed my faith to be shaken. Oh, what's the matter with me? I've always longed to help the needy, to do the things I never dared. This was the time for me to step up. So then why was I so scared? A warlord who shoots people in the face. What's so scary about that? I must trust that my Lord is mightier and always has my back. Now I must be completely devout. I can't have even one shred of doubt. I believe that the Lord God created the universe. I believe that He sent His only Son to die for my sins, and I